All right, welcome back. Our guest tonight, Isaac Arthur. Fascinating conversation. And when we come back after this break, we're going to talk about generational shifts and start to get to some of these phone calls. And they are completely jammed, and I understand why. Isaac is absolutely amazing. And this is how the universe is really strange to me. Last week, I had a dream. And that dream was about this house that is built underground in Las Vegas, and it's a bunker, and we all remember the movie with Christopher Walken, and where he was, you know, living in the bunker. But anyway, it was like that. So I had the dream, and the bunker is real, but I had this complete 8-hour dream about this bunker. Today it comes out in the news that house is for sale. What are the odds of that happening? I had the dream, and now it's for sale. It's built 26 feet underground. It's got a yard. It's got a lawn. It's got a pool. It's got trees. It's got a fake sky on the ceiling that mimics day and night. It's even got the constellations up there. It's 2 miles away from the Las Vegas Strip, and you get the whole thing for $18 million. It's 14,620 square feet, concrete and steel. It is a genuine doomsday bunker designed to survive nuclear events in total comfort. You wouldn't even know it. Isn't it weird that I had that dream? That's right. That's what we're talking, entanglement tonight with Isaac Arthur. And there's evidence of it going on right there. He is the host of Science and Futurism. The links to Isaac's YouTube channel are over at Coast to Coast AM. More with Isaac after this short break, and we'll get to your phone calls and all of these Twitter questions. Everything is next. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Isaac Arthur. Isaac, you've been listening to Coast since the beginning. Tonight's your first time on the show, and how does that make you feel? Because coming up next, we are going to the phones. You know, did you ever think you were going to be here?
Honestly, no. But it is, you know, one of the things we like to say about science and futurism is you get this community that builds up around it that's so awesome to interact with. And I know there's the same one for this channel, for this show. And it's just so awesome to see these kind of communities build up and grow and actually get to talk on one of these. You know, anyone who's listened to radio before has probably wondered about making a phone call, showing up as a guest on one of these. And it's a bit intimidating at times, to say the least, that you try not to think about how many people you're talking to. But it's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun, and I just lost my... Oh, okay. Are we back, Donna? Donna, just... My screen went blank. It's back. As I was reaching for the phones, my... anyway, it doesn't matter. But my screen went blank. We're good. All right, so, Isaac, you get to hear me say those magic words. We're going to go to Wild Card. Gordon in Plant City, Florida. You're up first on Coast. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Jimmy and Isaac. I know what a Dyson sphere is, and it's cool. And most of your listeners might not know. I saw on a Star Trek episode, Captain Picard was coming up to this huge Dyson sphere, and it surrounded a star. And it's just like Isaac said, it's either a huge structure or a group of structures that capture the energy of the star. And I wanted to mention that because, I mean, it's so easy to accidentally forget. And there's one other thing. You were struggling with the concept of going faster than the speed of light. Imagine going down a road, and the faster you go, the slower the ball bounces up and down. But Isaac can explain this to you. The perpendicular, the hypotenuse on the triangle, is you and I are both going at the speed of light because I'm going at the speed of light in space-time. I'm sitting perfectly still, but I'm going at the speed of light in time. And the faster I go in the space, the slower the time slows down because the ball can't go faster than that. And I wanted to run that concept by Isaac and see if that was a good explanation. And by the way, Isaac, you have a cool accent, man. What is your accent? I just have to know.
Well, it's not. I guess I do have an accent. It's a Cleveland accent. I'm an Ohioan, though I was actually born in California. But I have a bit of a speech impediment, and we've been working out over the years. But I'm not very good at pronouncing the letter R as in rabbit. So a bit of an Elmer Fudd thing for anyone listening. I'm sure everyone's noticed. But that Star Trek episode, I think, was called Relics.
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's Relics. You're good.
Scotty in it too, and of course we love to use that one example because I just remember seeing that on the TV when I was a kid, and it was stunning. And it's not normally what we mean by a Dyson sphere in the sense that it probably would be a swarm of habitats instead. But if you have artificial gravity and a lot of material, you could potentially build something like that. And you know, that's just such, you know, it's so mind blowing because something like that would have 2 billion times the surface area of Earth. And whether you're doing it as a swarm of habitats, just, you know, connected, or as one big structure, that's just so much room for us. For you could have whole giant habitats that were just devoted to types of life that went extinct as parks. That, you know, they could be the size of a planet, and they still would barely even cut into your mass budget or your area to live in.
Right, right.
And that's the future, potentially the future that we have ahead of us, and it's, you know, not for a long time to be sure. But that's just so awesome.
Yeah, it is. It is. And Gordon, thank you for the phone call. And
you're welcome. And thank you, buddy. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Gordon. You're absolutely right, Arthur. You would have entire colonies. It's like the movie Westworld, right? You would have something dedicated to the past, something to the future. You could have one that would just be a jungle, one that would be dedicated to extinct species. Because the question of space or energy is removed, right? You take that out of the equation. You can do whatever you want and have as much of it as you want.
With 2 billion times the living area, you know, that we have here on Earth, you could replicate every epoch of evolution and the history of this planet and have more room than they had in that era and still barely even cut into the space for people. And so, you know, you've got options for all the life we have right now on this planet that we've been kind of pushing to the corner, all the stuff that used to exist, and we can reconstruct that somehow, and even a lot of things we might only be able to make with a mix of technology and genetic engineering. And there's just, it's, you know, this is why it's so much fun to do the Fall Future episodes, is because they give us such cool options.
Well, what if we were able to just bypass the Dyson sphere necessity altogether, and we figured out miniature versions of fusion, or we figured out our own free energy source where we weren't tapping into the sun at all and we didn't need it, so therefore Dyson spheres aren't constructed, therefore ET wouldn't be looking for us and our Dyson sphere. They would have to go and look for something else.
Well, in some of those scenarios, you'd actually end up with something very similar to what we would expect from a Dyson sphere, because the constraint on those is you have to get rid of the waste heat. You know, you never destroy energy, you just change what form it is, and it comes out as heat. Assuming you're bound by thermodynamics, which you might not be, and if you're bound by the speed of light for communication, which again, you might not be, if you store those two constraints, you still end up looking like a Dyson sphere, even with fusion power, because you try to get as close to each other as you can, but you can't get too close because you got waste heat. You want to be as close as possible for travel and communication, though. So those would look the same, but if you have FTL communications or something to let you break the laws of thermodynamics, you could get a very different layout. And that's why we'd say that's one of the exceptions we'd say would ruin things like the Dyson dilemma, where we say we should be able to see all these giant civilizations that they exist because they'd be glowing in the diverged spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But we always try to walk inside the famous specific known physics, even though we know it's going to probably change on us in the next couple of centuries, just to make sure we can see what it would look like from what we know now.
Let's go to Wild Card 2, Carter in Texas. Carter, you're up next on Coast to Coast, man. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yep, we got you, Carter. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to ask Isaac if he's aware of any substantial advances or even studies being done into inertial dampening or inertial canceling. I did some calculations on space travel a while back, or any type of astral navigation. And, I mean, two G forces is uncomfortable. Five is almost you can't do anything. Eight to ten can kill a person in a matter of minutes. And if you could sustain 10 G forces for 6 months, you're still not even up to 5% the speed of light.
So that's a great – well, and how about making a turn at that speed, too, as well?
Yeah, that's bad, too. I mean
– right. Carter,
there's no way you could handle that G force for that long. And would a Cuvillieri type of system, since it's pulling instead of pushing, and it's pulling every molecule simultaneously, would that negate the inertial conflicts?
Isaac, okay. What do you think about that? Thank you for the phone call, Carter.
That's a very good question. There's a couple of in there, and it's fairly complex. For inertial damping, that's mostly still the realm of just theoretical papers and sci-fi, but there are some, you know, and as an author called Alastair Reynolds, who writes some really good hard science fiction on this concept that looks at inertial dampening. And it is exactly right that as long as you're keeping to biological life, and for my part, I'd like to stay biological, mostly so in the future, no matter how high tech we get.
It's a good idea.
The limitation of gravity or acceleration, they're more or less the same thing in Einstein's general relativity. You can't accelerate too fast. And there are ways we might be able to speed up a bit, the options for inertial, like we use for jet fighters, you know. But if you can find some way to just dampen that out, not only if you could, like, we have three types of mass. We have inertial mass, gravitational active mass, and gravitational passive mass. If you could find a way to suppress that inertial mass, not only could you accelerate faster, but you wouldn't need as much energy potentially to get up to those really high speeds. Only on the papers right now, we don't have anything to way to do this, but as we learn more about the Higgs boson, for instance, we might be able to find some way to tinker with that. It's a ways off, and we don't know what we'll be able to see on that, but that offers a lot of options. And I can't remember what the other question you asked was.
What, studio drive. To withstand that over time was the second part of the question, and you know, and obviously making a turn. And there's a lot of talk out there, and it's in science fiction too as well, where you have a gravitational bubble around you or your craft, that inside of that you aren't affected by gravity or g-forces, so making a right-hand turn at you know, half of the speed of light, it's you're not affected by it because the gravity on the inside is neutralized. And what about that type of situation where, look, the obvious is when you see the Orville or the Enterprise, you know, take off at, you know, with their warp drives, everybody's still sitting in their chairs like nothing is going on. And that simply can't be the case.
The screen.
Right.
Well, again, that's a big one, too. In all these science fiction things, we always see the inertial dampening, which is, of course, necessary for the show to make sense, as we see artificial gravity. But those two would actually probably be connected. If you can do the one, you can probably do the other, because you do have to play around with basically what do we mean by mass in the first place, which is actually a very complex topic. So again, it's not one single thing. But if you can find some way to do that, that does really help with the problems we have with space travel. Right now, you can't stop. You know, when you're driving down the road, you're constantly applying energy to overcome air drag. In space, where it's a vacuum, there's very little drag. There's actually a little bit. You can't stop because you've used up all your energy to do that, and it takes so much energy to get the speed that you probably only carry enough energy to slow down and maybe change course a little bit. If you have something that lets you play around with things like the rocket equation, so you're not carrying all that extra energy just to get up to speed, or that lets you just stop like they do in Star Trek or the Orville or so many other sci-fi shows, it changes the entire landscape for how we expect things like trade, interstellar trade, or space warfare, or things like that. And so, you know, we can guess how things might work under known physics, but if you change that things like inertial damping or artificial gravity, it really does change things. And if you can generate artificial gravity, you probably can deal with that acceleration issue, because, again, under general relativity, gravity and acceleration are the same thing.
Let's keep going down the line here. Let's go out to Maryland. Let's go to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Frank, you're up next on Coast.
Howdy, guys. Glad to be back with you. My question is either statingly brilliant or excessively dumb. Pretend I'm a 10-year-old. What was, before the sun and the stars formed, what was there? Was it a cold black nothingness? And could we determine the temperature at that time, at the start of the universe? If it was 1 million, what we know as Fahrenheit, I suspect your answer will be, I don't know.
No, actually, there's a lot on this. I can almost answer this, but I'm going to let Isaac do it because he's a lot smarter than I am. Thank you for the phone call, Frank. Isaac, before the Big Bang, what was actually there?
Well, we don't know what was before the Big Bang. We usually say there was no space at all. But when we say about what was the universe like, say, when the Earth was formed, it was actually hotter. It was denser and hotter. And when we talk about cosmic microwave background radiation, you know, and how that's 2.7 Kelvin really cold, when that light was actually created, and what we call this the event of last scattering, the entire universe was actually about the density of the upper atmosphere of the sun, and it was the temperature of the upper atmosphere of the sun. And that's actually as far back as we can see right now, about 300,000 years in the beginning of the universe, after the beginning of the universe, because we can't see around it. You're looking through a star, basically. The entire universe was this compact, hot thing. Now, if we get better at detecting neutrinos, we might be able to look even further back. But past that marker, last scattering event, we can only, you know, extrapolate what happened because we can't see it. And hopefully we'll be able to get better at seeing that. But as to what happened before the Big Bang, we just don't know. And the temperature at the moment of the Big Bang should have been, well, I was going to say infinite, but we usually say it's a Planck temperature, which is an insanely high temperature.
Right. And I think for most, as we head into this next break, the concept of everything that there is in our universe right now, because of the planets and the stars and asteroids and all of the matter that we have, the concept of all of that compressing down into something smaller than the head of a pin is the way people look at it. Like all of that mass. No, that's not the case. It's that things combined to make what we have. It's not that everything that we have was compressed down into nothing. It was electromagnetic energy, where the different elements, gases were formed, those combined and compressed, and that is what created the universe from nothing, from energy. It's not that everything was compressed and then just blew up and the stars were already there, but they were just compressed. It's not the case. It's the opposite. It was created from what was already there.
Oh, there was none of the matter that we think of as existing at this time was actually in play then. You couldn't actually have any chemicals until many thousands of years after the Big Bang, and you couldn't even have things like protons and neutrons for that very first instant because it was just too hot.
Right.
You don't even think all the forces existed at that point. That's where you get the grand unified theory, for instance. And, I mean, it's so speculative about what the circumstances were, you know, prior to those times, because how do we check that in a lab? How do you make something that's hotter than the sun in a lab? And we'd like to know because that's going to give us fusion and virtually free energy. So,
and there's another interesting thought that I have, which is how many, I mean, like right now, as you and I are talking, how many universes, how many Big Bangs happen that we never see because the math is just a little bit off? In other words, they literally go, you know, they start and stop. Ours was magical, right? Ours happened to work. But how many times does a Big Bang occur, but the math is slightly off? So it just expands, disappears, and you know, I would think that it happens all the time.
Quite possibly. That's one of those problems is we don't have a model for detecting how many other universes there are yet. There could be, we could really be the only one, or there could be a near infinite number of them, or even an infinite number of them. And how many of them had different, this is just different possibilities, the same iteration of our universe, where the rules are the same.
That's right.
You start getting ones that had different rules, where the speed of light was just 1% faster or slower, or 100 times faster or slower. And, you know, how it might be a finite number, but it's one of those numbers where you could wrap the entire planet and all those zeros you'd have to write down to list that number.
Let me jump in right there. We're going to take a quick break. Our guest tonight, Isaac Arthur. When we come back, more of your phone calls. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. What a great conversation tonight with Isaac Arthur. We're going to be getting back to all of your phone calls. And yes, you guys are watching what's going on Twitter. It's absolutely crazy over there. So I have a whole stack of Donna-approved Twitter questions that we're going to get to next. And I want to point everybody to this story that was just released. It's over at Coast to Coast AM in the news section right there. Because a mysterious dark vortex has been photographed on Neptune. NASA popped this, and it was done by Hubble this past September 2018. And they went over, going through the images, during a scan of Neptune's northern hemisphere. But check this out. It's never been seen before. This vortex measures about 6,800 miles across and it's turning away near the planet's North Pole. You've got to check it out over at coasttocoastam.com. Isaac Arthur is our guest, and this is the deal. When you go to Isaac's YouTube channel, go to his playlist. He has elegantly placed everything in groups where you can go and just fire this off and do an evening, a night of the Fermi Paradox. You can go through a night of colonization. It's all right there, and it's easy to get to. Click on Isaac's name over at coasttocoastam.com. With that, I'm going to be back after this short break, taking more of your phone calls with Isaac. All of that is next. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. What a great conversation tonight with our guest, Isaac Arthur. We're going through all of the principles of what a civilization would have to do to get here and what we would have to do if we were going to do the same thing and expand out and go interstellar. Everything from dark energy and faster than light travel and, of course, Dyson spheres and the Fermi paradox. We're going to get it all in tonight, and we're going to get back to the phones right now. Are you ready, Isaac?
Ready to go.
Let's go. Let's go out east. Let's go to Janet out in Manhattan, New York. Janet, you're up next on Coast.
Hi, thank you. Okay, here's my question. I've been trying to understand this for a while, and maybe Mr. Arthur can explain it. A while ago, this is about the speed of light and why Einstein thought that the speed of light was the limiting velocity in the universe. And as I understand, I was reading a book, The Cosmic Code by Heinz Pagels from 1984, a very interesting book. And Einstein did this thought experiment where he tried to imagine himself catching up with a beam of light and traveling at the speed of light. And he decided this could not happen. And it said because of Maxwell's theory of radiation. I'm not sure of electromagnetic radiation. I'm not sure what that is. But my guess is, does it have to do with the fact that if Einstein is traveling at the speed of light, then relative to Einstein, light is standing still, and that cannot happen. And from that, he concludes, okay, so nothing and no one can ever travel at the speed of light. Is that correct?
More or less so, yeah. With electromagnetic radiation, if you're ever looking for an example of that, the light coming off your light bulb right now, your screen, that's electromagnetic radiation. It's just a very tiny piece of it in the visible spectrum. If you're picturing a flashlight for the moment and you turn that on, you wouldn't expect the beam of light that came out a second later after you turned it on to catch up the part that were a second ahead of it. And again, this is one of the problems when you actually try to talk about anything with mass moving at the speed of light, is that there is no time passing. As you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time slows down for you and stops completely at the speed of light. So you can't really catch up or experience anything at all. But for the light beam, if you're getting closer and closer to it, you're never going to catch up to it. If you send that light beam ahead of you, you will never catch up to it. And the weird thing that we found out from Michelson Morley that started the entire relativity thing off was that you would still measure that going to speed of light as far as you were concerned, even though you're going so close to the speed of light yourself.
Thank you, Janet. Oh, Janet's gone. I didn't even see that Janet left us. Okay, I hope she picked up on that. She probably took it offline. I didn't catch that. Let's go to first-time caller, Dan, Grand Prairie, Texas. You're up next on Coast.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight? It's really good to talk to you.
You're doing good, Dan. What have you got for Isaac?
Well, I know that they've just done a new mission to the sun, and they say that the surface of the sun is 3,000 degrees, but the corona is 3 million. I wonder if there's some kind of matter-antimatter interaction going on that's transferring that energy across that distance.
Well, that can be kind of confusing, folks, sometimes. The surface of the sun is several thousand degrees Kelvin, and whereas the corona is actually a lot hotter, and people find themselves thinking, well, how can you have the part that's further out? Why is that hotter? And this is actually one of those interesting things that we always tell people in science fiction, you know, space is so cold. In fact, space is usually very hot. It's always sunny in space out by Earth, for instance. And there are nebulae out there that are as hot as the sun, even though you wouldn't burn up going through them because heat is not just a matter of temperature, but how much of it there is. That's why you can open the door on your oven and not be bored, even though it's hotter than your stovetop is. put your hand in a thing of boiling water, it's cooler than your oven, but it's going to burn you a lot faster because there's so much more matter there to transfer energy.
Right.
Now, the corona's a little tricky to explain on that one. I might suggest looking that one up so I don't give a bad answer, but the corona is hotter in some ways because a lot of the material that's being blown out by that is getting radiated again as the sun, as it leaves the sun, it's still absorbing all that light. And obviously, a lot of it's getting pushed away by the solar wind. But I hesitate to give a better answer to that because I am not in that particular area of astronomy, so I might botch it.
Well, and we do understand, you know, we've talked to enough astronauts that have experienced this, and they have tried to get us to try to relate to what's going on in that it's directly in the sun. They are dealing with about 250 degrees. And then you can zip behind anything that is creating a shadow, and in that shadow be at minus 250 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The only way to transfer heat on the Earth, I can put my hand on a metal rod, and that's conductive heat transfer. I can have the heat, come up to my hot air, convection. But in space, your only option is radiation, the heat being given off by things. So if you block that light, that radiation, you're going to freeze to death very quickly. And it's very easy to freeze in space by blocking out the sun, but only if you've got something in the way. And, of course, in most of the solar system, there's nothing in the way. So around the Earth, you can freeze or burn very quickly. You get off anywhere from the Earth a decent ways, and you can just heat up very quickly because nothing's blocking the sun from you. But you put even a tiny thin foil meal between you and the sun, you'd freeze.
Now, before I get back to the phone calls, I want to address one thing directly, which is generational ships. And in Arthur C. Clarke's series, Rama, the Rama series, which I have read multiple times. Isaac, I get to the end of each one of those books, and I just flip it over and I start over again. And I've done this since the books were released. You reference Rama quite a bit in your material, which is great because I can relate to it. I've read it so many times. But his concept, and Arthur C. Clarke, I think, is in the know. He's been read in. He knows way too much, or knew too much. But his concept was just that Rama, this interstellar spacecraft, approaches our solar system. And although we don't know what it is at the time, it turns out to be a generational ship. It's a ship that is moving around interstellar, collecting different species and then depositing them at a central, I forget what they called. What do they call the central hub?
Depot. There was a name for it, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember it either.
Times, but the last book I haven't read that many times. Gone with Rama. It wasn't Gone
with Rama. Rendezvous with Rama.
Rendezvous was the original, yeah.
Yes.
That one I've read many times. Of course, I'd recommend that to everybody because it's a classic of science fiction.
It absolutely is astounding book, and I can't wait for the movie. I am just...
Why is there a movie coming out?
No, that's my point. Thank you for reacting that way. But now we're talking about generational ships. In that, it's presented in the book where you are going to go through multiple generations, mothers and fathers, and children, multiple generations and civilizations and establishments are going on these ships. E.T. would probably do the same thing in coming here. Would the ships be that large and vice versa? If we're going to go out and go in interstellar, or do we have to go generational?
It depends. I mean, of course, we might one day find some way to get around the whole speed of light issue, but if we don't, we can still do it. But we have to use the generation ship approach, or possibly some of the options like freezing ourselves, or potentially even something like life extension, where the crew could survive the entire time themselves because they just didn't age. But if you're sticking to normal biology, the limitation there is you can't get to these stars in a single human lifetime. And if you're trying to keep a colonial mission going, you can't be using four or five people like we descend to the moon or maybe to Mars. You need to send a real splinter of your civilization that can keep itself going. So you almost have to use one of these gigantic spaceships like we see in Rendezvous with Rama. And, you know, that is obviously quite the undertaking to build something like that. But it's got to really last because you're worried about things breaking. You have to be able to fix. You're worried about leakage from the ship constantly because over a century, you're losing a lot of material. You have to recycle very efficiently. And of course, the big one is you have to maintain that civilization, because you've got people as great, great grandkids. They didn't train for that mission themselves, or they were born and raised to it. But you've got to maintain all that knowledge base, maintain all that, you know, all that equipment.
How do you have a right? If somebody that leaves the Earth as a geologist, well, okay, they've been working with rocks here on planet Earth. Now, how do you have a geologist 500 years from now?
Well, that's kind of tricky. You know, you're on one of these spaceships, and it might have artificial soil on the inside of it, but it doesn't have any geology. So you left Earth with a geologist, and you're certainly going to need geologists when you arrive at some planet around another star. But it might be kind of hard to actually get, you know, you can store the data, of course, so people can learn from records. But you can't really have anyone active in the field for some mission that might last centuries, because who wants to go into geology on board a spaceship that's got no geology?
Right.
So how do you retrain them at the destination, even if you've got that knowledge?
And you have that, I just said geologist, but you've got it in every single specialty that you would plan for in leaving Earth, or ET coming here. It would be the exact same situation where you would have to generationally prep for, because you need those same experts wherever you are going to survive.
Oh, yes. And it gets a little bit worse than that, because in geology's case, everybody said there's no geology on the spaceship. But if you're limited by light lag and you've only got a couple hundred people or 1,000 people on one of these ships, you're not really going to get too much science done, not just because you don't have very many people, but because back home on Earth with billions of people and millions of scientists, they're getting real research done. Anyone on that spaceship who's getting, you know, their data 20, 30 years out of date, it's going to be very hard for them to motivate themselves to really passionately embrace science when they are, when they're getting their articles from like 1960 as it were. They're going to feel behind with whatever they do. So it's going to be kind of hard for them to really feel like they're cutting edge on science when it's all being done effectively from their point of view, far ahead in the future or back home.
Now, if we, I'll get back to the phone calls in a second, but these are very important questions I've got to get to Isaac. If you, you and I, Isaac, we're out and we're approaching a planet that we know has life, and we have been able to collect data on the civilization. We know what they look like. We know what their language is. We've studied the atmosphere is cool. The oxygen nitrogen mix is good. We know that we can go down. But do we? Do you step off of the ship and go down and face these, the civilization face to face? Or do we create a facsimile of you and I, an android with biological features on the outside that either look like you or look like them, but we don't take the chance of us going down?
I think, and again, they might have better technology, better methods, so I wouldn't want to rule out completely, but with what we have now, you wouldn't want to land in person if you had other options available, drones or robots or androids, because while you don't really have to worry about transferring viruses, if their environment's anything like yours, it's so easy to cross-infect them. Some little microbiota in your system could easily end up becoming some plague for them.
Right.
Not because they got sick from it, but because it turns out that all you know, little biome there works better on their planet than their stuff does. And suddenly they've got, kind of like with the rabbits in Australia. And, you know, you don't want to shock them with something that looked very inhuman. So I would think the best way to go would be probably not even show up as the equivalent of, like, android humans or aliens in that case, but probably something like a remote board or some other critter that they really didn't pay attention to that you could absorb some information about them first. And then as you learn more, as you get the specifics, as you get confident, then you go for a forced contact situation. Though I don't think you want to delay it too long, because it kind of starts getting to the point of being spying and a privacy issue, you know, all in the name of science and diplomacy. But how long do you collect that data before it starts becoming kind of, spying for all practical purposes?
Well, and if you are an ancient civilization, let's pull a round number out. A million, nice small number, a million years more advanced than us. You're an intelligent civilization. You just got a jump start on us by a million years. You went through it all, Industrial Revolution, computer age, internet, boom, you've conquered energy. You're now out there mapping and collecting data on this Milky Way, on our galaxy. Wouldn't you build a self-replicating satellite drone probe situation where you would go out to different asteroids and planets and investigate and then build more probes and then continue to explore the Milky Way that way? You wouldn't use biological versions of yourself.
Well, there's actually two different concepts there, and this is sometimes what we call von Neumann probe. It's when it goes out, it finds some piece of matter to mine, and it makes more copies of itself to spread out to the rest of the galaxy and do more exploring. And each does the same. They stop somewhere, they scan it, make copies of themselves, go explore more. But we'd often say that this was an unmanned approach, and I would tend to say that you would probably never actually do that too far out, because either you're going to be sending something with a decent amount of intelligence to be making decisions, which at that point is then arguably a person anyway, thus it's not unmanned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this kind of context, we can't really be saying what qualifies as a person when we're talking about things that are a million years ahead of us technologically. Or you'd, you know, be very careful throwing out self-replicating machines in the universe, because that'd be a sign of kind of aggression if you weren't doing that very carefully. Because there's so many ways that can go wrong. Something we call gray goo. Your von Neumann probe ends up destroying some civilization because it's mutated on its code and doesn't remember or doesn't know, because it's not small enough, how to tell that the planet it's now harvesting to make more probes is somebody's home. So you'd almost always send it out with a human level intelligence or more if you could, at which point it's not unmanned anymore. And that civilization that, you know, that might not be biological, but as far as they're concerned, that might be a person. So I don't think you send a lot of unmanned probes out.
Well, I'm not afraid as I used to be of gray goo. It used to terrify me, the idea of, you know, self-replicating nanobots, you know, just swarming over my town and city and taking things over. I'm not afraid of that. And the reason why, very, very basic, energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, yeah. What are they going to have, little micro solar panels on it? Well, that would be bigger than the goo itself, and that'd be difficult. Anyway, energy. How are they going to charge?
There's two problems with something like that is they can only replicate so fast. And every protection you put on them to protect them from something like EMP, for instance, that's extra mass and extra stuff it has to slow it down reproducing.
That's right.
And, of course, you have to supply the energy to it. And I think we were trying to figure out one time what it would take to terraform Mars with nanotechnology, where it was building everything from scratch. And the fastest you could pump the energy in there without melting the place, I think it would work out to be around 30 years.
Okay, let's stop right there. Yeah, I need to take a break. 30 years. We're going to follow that when we come back. Plus your phone calls. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.